Welcome on, Senior.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show 57 in chapter 11.
we're beginning chapter 11.
Yeah.
And so chapter 11 is going to cover the second, third, and fourth sessions of the Second Vatican Council.
Okay.
So the last time, the last chapter, we spent the entire section just on the first session.
Right.
So we're going to whiz through a little bit faster.
Kind of start a stop us. A little confusion in the beginning. All right. Yeah. So what happens in the sections?
On June 3rd of 1963, word went out that Pope John of the 23rd died. And so Mass was held, and Cardinal Sunens, he did the eulogy for it. The rest of the cardinals then stayed around in order to elect John's successor. As it always happens, the piazza is absolutely filled. They estimate 100,000 people were there to hear their new pope. This is on June 21st. The announcer of this, the person who would declare the next pope, is none other than Cardinal Ottaviani. Now, remember, he's had a rough first session. You know, I mean, he was just trying to hold the line, ask serious questions, and he was being lampooned. Jokes were made about him. He got into
They were inaccurate, right?
Yeah. And he got into some serious arguments with some of the other cardinals. And, of course, he could hold his own because he was fluent in Latin and didn't need notes.
You know? And many words.
Yeah. So, anyway, he's the one who's going to make the announcement. And he comes out, and he's standing there at the microphone, and he announces, Habemus Papam, we have a pope. Yeah. And then he begins intoning, and he does it very haltingly. So he begins by saying, Eminentissimus ac venerabimissibus Dominus Ioannem Baptistam. Pause. Montini.
So they had to wait.
Yeah.
Who was this John the Baptist?
No, yeah. He had to drag it out of himself. He was not happy. Okay. Montini was one of the progressives who had been pushing for more and more change. And so now he's elected pope, and he takes the title Pope Paul VI. Well, after an election, you have the celebratory luncheon. At this point, Pope Paul reappoints Cardinal Ciccone as the Secretary of State. He begins receiving then the obedience of each of the cardinals who come to him. And then after that, he announced that he was going to go to his quarters and begin working on a television address in which he would, as the new pope, make a public statement. He also announced that the council would begin on September 29th rather than September 8th. So he wanted to have another 21 days, 3 weeks, in order to make preparations for the council. And then also he announced that the coordinating commission would begin its work on July 3rd. So they would have a couple months in order to put together things. And this way, it would not be as chaotic as the first session was. Because remember that everything was all set.
Right.
And then one old cardinal steps up there and just blew everything up.
Right.
So. The fact of the matter is that Paul VI had very little experience as far as a parish priest. He was a parish priest for 1 year after his ordination. And then after that, he was sent to the Gregorian for graduate work. Then after that, to the Vatican Foreign Service, serving first of all in Poland as the Vatican's diplomat in Warsaw, and then was returned back to Rome when his health began to deteriorate. He was a young man, but he was not real healthy. And so he was brought back, and he arrives back in Italy. I don't know if he'd want to be in Italy when he arrived because Benito Mussolini was in charge of the country. He was running the country. That didn't scare Montini. You know, Father Montini went ahead and organized Catholic youth. He was not ashamed of saying anti-fascist statements. Surprising that he didn't get arrested or worse, you know. But,
it is surprising.
Yeah, but he seemed to have been able to get away with it all. And then after the Second World War was over, although he was still working in the diplomatic corps, he was openly at odds with the Secretary of State. This is Cardinal Tardini, because Tardini and Pope Pius XII took a very strong stand against the communists and against the Soviet Union. And Father Montini thought that we should be negotiating with them and trying to see if there was common ground. This is a very difficult kind of a thing. And now as Pope, we'll see later on, he actually fulfills some of that in what's called the Ostpolitik, politics of the East. When he arrived as Archbishop of Milan, the Patriarch of Milan, he had 90 cases of books with him. Not a lot of other personal possessions, but he certainly was a book reader, and he kept his books too. He is a good friend of Cardinal Sunan's. When the conclave was held that elected him, everyone knew where he was, what he stood for, and what kind of a person he was. And so what we have then is, as the council is about to start its second session, he appoints a steering committee in order to direct the session. And this way, he'll make sure that there aren't any of these glitches like it happened in the first session. But the interesting thing is that the cardinals that he places in this steering session are people like Sunan's, he keeps on popping up, Dipfner, Lercaro, and also an Armenian patriarch, Agagnani. All of them are progressives. So the council now is definitely in the hands of the progressive wing of the cardinals. Right from the very beginning, we know that this is going to be different. There's going to be something different about this, because when the opening ceremony takes place, Pope Paul enters St. Peter's, and first of all the other cardinals and bishops go in before him, and they walk in, and they're carrying their mitres in their hands rather than wearing them. And then he himself is carried into the vestibule of St. Peter's on the Sedia Gestatoria, which is something that John the 23rd used to love to ride. And he arrives, and then he is dismounted from the Sedia Gestatoria at the entrance itself. And then he enters by foot carrying a mitre in his hand, not the tiara. So we're seeing some interesting symbolism that's bouncing around. So then at the very beginning of the second session, Paul VI gives a speech, a talk to the assembly. It's about an hour long, and it introduces four themes. This is what he would like to see come out of the council. And the first thing is a new awareness of the church's inner nature. Now, he doesn't define what that is. I mean, we already have Pope Pius XII's Mystici Corporis, which is pretty clear. We also have that one document that was bounced around and then sent back called De Ecclesia, concerning the church. That's going to be reworked and then represented. So we're not really sure, and he's leaving that basically up to the Council Fathers to figure that out. Okay. But the first thing is a new awareness of the church's inner nature. Second is a call for reform and renewal. Even in the first session, you heard that word bounced around all the time of aggiornamento, and here you have him saying basically the same thing, but he also puts a cautionary break on that, and he says the following, I quote here, "Not by turning upside down the present way of life or breaking with what is essential and worthy of her tradition, but by stripping it of what is unworthy and defective." And again, he leaves it up to the Council Fathers to figure out what's unworthy and defective. Third mandate he gives to the Council Fathers is look for ways, try to find ways to bring about the unity of all Christians. You know, there's a very popular movement underway in Catholic theology at the time called New Theology. And New Theology is really grounded in Christocentrism, which it should be. Everything is ultimately about Christ.
Right.
And this new emphasis, some people felt as though this is a way in which the Catholic Church would be able to put its hand out to Protestants and do some reconciliation as much as possible. And so this is one of the things that he said. He even said this. He went on, and I quote here, "If we are to blame in any way for that separation, we humbly beg God's forgiveness and ask pardon, too, of our brethren who feel themselves to have been injured by us."
Okay. That's a reasonable statement.
That's a reasonable statement, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then finally, the last thing that he calls for is a dialogue between the church and the modern world. That would include the affirming of religious liberty as a fundamental right for all peoples. And then to seek for ways to aid, and I'm quoting again here, the oppressed, the poor, and the suffering. And later on, we'll see this very clearly in one of his encyclicals, A Populum Progressio. So the next day, Monday, is the first session, and the first schema that's presented is De Ecclesia. The council fathers read over it. It has been totally reworked. It is not the same document that was rejected last time around, and particularly the progressives were very happy with this new version. In fact, that included Cardinal Ritter, who on October 3rd made an intervention in which he spoke about that as being so positive. It's at this point that I'm reading along while I'm reading all these books about the Second Vatican Council. I'm keeping Bishop Forster's, remember Marion Forst of Dodge City, Kansas, St. Louis, and that he kept a diary. And so I'm always reading that because it's some interesting insights. And here he says the following. He's only been back a couple days, but he writes in his diary, "It is unfortunate, with all the preparations made and funds expended, that the wisdom of such a system, that is to say simultaneous translations, could not have been anticipated. Many are at a loss to follow the talks closely, and much of what is said eludes me."
Wow.
Well, you know, he is not alone, and there are a lot of bishops that really didn't study their Latin like they should have back when they were in the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's coming back to bite them. I think I mentioned last time around how the translation took place, in which a council father read his speech in Latin, but it had been written by one of his experts, his pariti. He told them what to say. They did it. So then copies of his speech were then handed out to the other council fathers, who then went back to their own apartments and gave the Latin copies to their pariti, who then translated it into French or German or Italian or Spanish or English or whatever, so that they could understand what they had just heard that day.
So it's been passed on multiple times already at that point to each
yeah.
of them.
So
and then to reply, it has to reverse the process.
Do the same thing over again, yeah. So that really bogged things down.
Uh-huh.
Either they should have stopped for a while and had everyone go back to Latin school, or they should have just used the simultaneous translation modes, which was being used in the United Nations already. On October 14th, an interesting little kerfuffle came up. Cardinal Ritter himself spoke about the collegiality of bishops. And at that point, looking over one of the documents, read Peter and the Apostles. And Cardinal Elfrink was one of the progressives from the Netherlands, right away jumped up and objected. And he says, no, it's not Peter and the Apostles, but Peter and the other Apostles, because Peter is an Apostle.
Wow.
You see what he's doing there?
Yes, I see exactly what he's doing
yeah.
there.
Yeah, so they're trying wow. to work out the relationship between bishops and popes.
Pope.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the First Vatican Council, mm-hmm. they felt as though this was unfulfilled, uncompleted discussion. And so we're going to see the Second Vatican Council is going to do an awful lot toward moving toward collegiality. And with that, it's going to cause a real problem for Pope Paul VI later on when he promulgates on his own the encyclical Humanae Vitae. And some of these progressives, he is a progressive, some of these progressives are going to be very upset about that because it wasn't, quote unquote, collegial.
It wasn't, right.
Yeah.
It wasn't what they wanted it to be.
Yes. Uh-huh. And so one of the patriarchs was also speaking about this same issue. And on October 7th, this is the patriarch Maximus IV. And he gets up and he breaks all the rules by giving an intervention in French. And he gets away with it. What are you going to do, you know? What he is emphasizing here is that the head of the church is actually Christ, and the Pope is the head of the church only as he is a successor to St. Peter, and that Peter was one of the 12 apostles, and the power of the Pope does not diminish the power of the bishops. That sounds an awful lot like our own Peter Richard Kenrick. You know, if you go back to Volume 2 and his interventions at the First Vatican Council, at least until they shut him down, he was basically saying the same thing, keep out of my backyard. I'm the bishop here. And that goes back to the Gallicanism that really developed during and after the French Revolution, when so many of those Sulpicians fled from France and they went to Ireland and they helped to infuse the faculty at Maynooth. And guess where he studied? And then also Sulpicians coming here to the United States and also bringing along with them that sense of semi-Gallicanism. So it's an interesting position. That same day, Cardinal Cushing left the council. This is the second time. He left the first council early, the first session. Now the second session, he leaves again. He goes back home to Boston, and he complains about ulcers or something like that. But he said quite openly, the reason I've got these ulcer problems is because of the not having simultaneous translation. So he's another one that flunked his Latin back in seminary. So around the same time then, the discussion came up about the restoration of the permanent diaconate. And that was an interesting discussion. Basically, the African fathers were dead set against the restoration. Mainly their fear was that if the permanent diaconate came about in their dioceses, fewer men would be interested in priesthood, and they needed priests because they were relying very heavily on missionaries from Europe and America, and they really wanted to have their own indigenous clergy. So they were tended to be against that. At one point, Cardinal Ottaviani made a speech in which he attacked the Pariti who had been politicking. You know, they're supposed to be experts for their particular bishop. But what they were doing was they were going around talking to other bishops and talking about the restoration of the permanent diaconate.
So there's some lobbying going on.
There's a little bit of lobbying going on, yeah. And again, he did this entirely without resorting to notes from his own. He didn't name names, but people pretty much knew who he was talking about. And particularly, he was talking about Karl Rahner from the University of Tübingen. Rahner, in fact, progressives had asked him to put together literally a legal argument for the restoration of the permanent diaconate, and he did, and it's quite an extensive work. And then the other one who was going around talking about the restoration of the permanent diaconate was none other than Joseph Ratzinger. And then also another, Gustav Martelet, who was a lecturer at the Gregorian Institute. And already Martelet was looked upon rather askance because he was a very strong follower of the Jesuit Teilhard de Chardin.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So finally, you had the schema on bishops and diocesan governance that's presented. This is in November. It is presented by Luigi Carli, Bishop of Segni, Italy. And when he presents it, he basically says that this is the work of the Curia only and kind of tips the hat, saying that there was no input from outside sources. So right away, that's going to cause people to look at it and wonder about it. And so there's going to be a lot of discussion on this one as a result. In fact, over the next 2 weeks, 149 council fathers made suggestions to change the schema.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a bunch.
That's a lot.
And it's of the 149, six of them were American, and that included our own Cardinal Ritter. And so he wanted to change the title entirely and to eliminate the Curia. He said this, he said, the Roman Curia exists only because it is delegated by the Roman Pontiff. So the various offices that serve the Pope in Rome, in the Vatican, his point is that they serve the Pope, but they're not serving me.
Okay.
And he's implying that they're kind of an impediment to his independence. So there we are again. in the history of councils, the popes never attend. So on November 6th, the Pope did something very unusual. He entered the council chambers in St. Peter's itself. Popes never do that. At the beginning of a session, they come in, they give an opening address, and then at the end of the session, then they give another address. That's happened all throughout history.
Okay.
Now, popes do not attend councils. You know, it's just, I can't think of any that actually did. What happens is that they, outside of the council, they're listening in on what's going on.
Sure.
And certainly John the 23rd did. He had a speaker set up so that he could listen to all of the speeches and interventions. And then he'd be able to get a hold of one cardinal here or this bishop over there and kind of give it a little bit input. But going to the council is very strange. Anyway.
It seems to me that feeds into the he's another bishop.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes and no.
Oh, no?
See, he's
okay.
Playing both ends here because what
oh, sure. Okay. He can come in and make a comment, which could affect the – okay.
Yeah. So he's going to come in, and one thing is – he helps to celebrate or assists at the Mass that's celebrated in the Ethiopian Rite. That was very interesting. I don't remember if this is the Mass or there was another one, but there was one in which he told the Master of Ceremonies at St. Peter's that he wanted to serve as deacon in a Mass. And the Master of Ceremonies says, Holy Father, you can't do that. You're Pope. And he said, but I'm also a deacon. I was ordained a deacon. And I think he got away with it.
Really?
Yeah. There's some very interesting things that go on.
Wow.
And so anyway, what happens at this particular occasion, he goes in, he sits down with the council of presidents. Remember, there are three presidents there. And he personally introduces a schema on missions. That's kind of unheard of.
Okay.
And then goes on to say this, and I quote here. He said, "We believe, therefore, that the text will be easily approved by you, even after having noted the necessity of final approval." And then he left. And he was wrong. Because when they took the vote, they're in favor, the Plotzets, were 311. And non-Plotzet, no, we don't accept this, 1,601.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a shock.
And that was on, what was it they were
this
doing?
This was on the missions.
The missions.
Yeah.
Okay.
So basically what they did was they took that scheme and set it on the side, sent it back to the committee, rewrite this. And then they went on to get back to the question of the authority of residential bishops. And so now they're working on that again. And again, this is Cardinal Ritter. Very interesting, because after the first session, he wrote to several bishops in the correspondence in between the two sessions, and he said, I'm a little surprised at myself that I even spoke up. I didn't think I was going to say anything, and I ended up saying quite a bit. He says, but that's going to change. I'm not going to do that anymore. Well, that didn't happen.
Right.
Yeah. And so here he is again speaking, and he says that the role of a residential bishop, that is to say an ordinary, okay, who's running a diocese, is exercised under the, quote here, jurisdictional primacy of the Roman pontiff. So here he's recognizing that relationship between the local bishop and the pope. Mm-hmm. And the pope does have jurisdiction over other bishops and dioceses. Mm-hmm. Well, Cardinal Frings, who we're getting used to hearing getting up and making statements, he jumped in and he questioned the power of the curia. And so in other words, the two of them are basically saying, this is between me and the pope, and these other guys, they're just here to assist him, not to be the go-betweens. And then at one point, he actually went and said, some of the curia offices, they could actually be staffed by laymen rather than by priests and bishops and cardinals. And that brought some applause. So things are a little wacky,
Right.
And then the whole question came up, discussion about national conferences. And Cardinal McIntyre of Los Angeles made an intervention. He pointed out that national conferences are entirely voluntary associations, that you don't have to, like for instance, in the United States, an American bishop does not have to be a member of the USCCB, that if the USCCB were to try to give a directive that everyone should do this, it would be up to individual bishops to decide to accept that or not. Now, there are those who argue that national conferences have more clout than that. And in fact, they do nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, I'll give you two examples in which very rather current ones that didn't happen. And one of those was in 2001, when the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001. That afternoon, there was an office at the USCCB that sent out to all the dioceses of the United States a prayer, asking them to pray this prayer because of the horrible massacre. And a couple of the dioceses sent it back and said, no, we'll write our own prayer. Who do you think you are telling us how to pray? And then more seriously, in 2005, when you had the Dallas Charter that came out for protecting God's children, a couple of the dioceses held out and did not go along with that either. And it wasn't because they were against it. What they were doing was they were showing, we're independent. You can't tell us what to do. So that's Cardinal McIntyre saying it's totally up to the individual bishop. Cardinal Ritter from here in St. Louis says, no, that the decisions of the conferences are binding on everybody. And then you have somebody in the middle, and that being Cardinal Meyer of Chicago. And what he's saying is that McIntyre is right, it is voluntary, unless it has something to do with us dealing with the Vatican and Vatican approval, and then it becomes mandatory.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Big so how did it play out?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
No, I think ultimately it's played out in so far as after the council was over, national conferences became extremely important in the governance of the church, and they continue to do so now, as well as these international synods in which the Pope calls bishops in, cardinals in, and asks their advice on various issues. And then those issues are – they heavily influence papal policy afterwards.
Okay.
So they do carry a real significance that they would not have before.
Okay. I think we are out of time.
Wow.
For this session already. So we'll end this session.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
of book three, version 57 of chapter 11.
Right.
We'll get that right here. All right. Shall we close with a prayer?
Sure.
Your blessing.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thank you so much, Monsignor.
Okay. Sure enough.